This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site, thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live shows or to our past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can also listen on your Nokia phone via satellite. Just go to the website for details on that. I'm very pleased to have with us a young woman, Anna Balzer. Anna is a 28-year-old Jewish American Columbia graduate. She's a Fulbright scholar and the granddaughter of Holocaust survivor. She is a three-time volunteer with the International Women's Peace Service, where she documented human rights abuses in the West Bank and supported the nonviolent movement against the occupation. She has spent most of the last 2 years in Palestine or on tour with her book, Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Anna, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. This is really an incredible honor. I can't tell you. You know, of course, I'm Palestinian, or maybe you didn't know.
I didn't know, but I'm honored to talk to you.
Thank you. Yes, I am. I was born in Ramallah in the West Bank, so this is I'm very tickled to have you here. Here we go. Tell us how it felt to be a Jewish American woman in the occupied territories. I mean, I know for a fact when I go to Ramallah or when I go to the West Bank, we can't even get a Jewish taxi cab driver to drive us into the West Bank. They have fear. And oftentimes it's genuine fear. Sometimes I think it's an exaggerated fear. At least at one time it was a more exaggerated fear. Now certainly there is certainly a lot more danger there now. How did this come about for you?
Well, I actually just 5-6 years ago had no idea about any of this stuff. In fact, I was just sort of a regular average Jewish American with a very positive feeling to Israel. And it was actually after I graduated from college, and I was living in Turkey teaching English, and as an avid backpacker, I decided to go south and travel a bit in the Middle East. And so that's when I went for the first time to Iran and Syria and Lebanon. And it was during those travels that I started to meet Palestinians for the first time. And I didn't even know who the Palestinians were or where Palestine was. But through my friendships with families that I got to know on those travels, I started to hear for the first time a completely different version of the history and present of the area from anything I had ever heard or learned growing up as a Jewish American. And my first reaction was disbelief. I thought, no way, you know, this is propaganda what these people are saying. Israel is defensive. Israel is virtuous. And I went out to kind of prove myself right, and in fact, I realized quickly how little I knew, and that's when I decided to go to Palestine. And as far as, you know, how I felt as a Jewish person in Palestine, I felt extraordinarily welcomed by the Palestinian people. That was not something I would have expected, given that so much aggression is done in the name of Jewish people and in the name of Americans, and I'm both. But people were very hospitable and kind to me, as long as it was clear that I was coming in not, you know, as a soldier or a settler, but coming in as somebody who wanted to understand better what they were experiencing. And I mean, the fact that, getting a Jewish taxi driver to drive you into the area is hard is no surprise. Of course, we're talking, and you know this better than me, Basiman. It's always sort of humbling to be talking about this with a Palestinian who surely you know more about any of this than I ever could, and you're my teacher, but at least I can offer a few of my experiences. But the situation there is one of total segregation. So for the most part, the roads are even segregated. There's one kind for Israelis. There's one kind for Palestinians, and the Palestinian ones are often unusable. There are roadblocks placed on them by the Israeli army. The Israeli people who live in the area get to use nice roads, and the Israelis living in the area are settlers who are Jewish. Meanwhile, the Palestinians are mostly Muslim and Christian. So basically, you have two kinds of roads. One, if you are Jewish, you get the nice roads. And then if you're a Palestinian, Christian, or Muslim, you get the roads that may not even be usable. And so just one example of the segregation, separation, or another word for both of those things, apartheid system, currently in the occupied West Bank.
May I ask you how your family feels about your book and your position on the Israeli-Palestine situation, Anna?
Well, their first reaction is different from their position now. Their first reaction, my mother's, for example, was one of incredible horror might be an exaggeration, but she was shocked and alarmed and thought, what has happened to my daughter? What did they tell her? But she was a wonderful enough mother to trust me and also to respect that I was doing what I had to do to go there to Palestine. And as she read what I wrote when I was over there, she began to really understand, and she is now very sympathetic. My father had been sympathetic really all along, and there are people in my family who refuse to come see me talk, who don't talk to me. Then there are also people in my family, like I have a great uncle who was involved in the Belgian resistance, and he is one of my biggest supporters. He has read my book and makes many comparisons to what he struggled through as a young child living in Belgium. So it's sort of all across the map, but I'm certainly lucky since I do know people who have lost their families because of their position on this issue, and including Israeli refuseniks who are put in jail for refusing to serve, or even are disowned by their families, can't have certain jobs, et cetera.
Exactly. Unfortunately, it's a highly controversial position for any Jewish American to take, or any Jew to take. And first of all, I have to tell you, I think that is extremely brave. No matter how honorable we set ourselves up to be, it is difficult to fight society and the standard that's set by society, especially the societies that we grow up in and the societies that we live in. And to take a step such as this is huge, and I think you're an extremely brave person.
Well, that's very kind of you. I mean, I think it's appropriate to point out that certainly it takes, you know, some amount of initiative and courage to do this, but how much easier it is for me. I mean, what I'm up against is much less than a Palestinian person were they to say the exact same things that I do. As a Jewish person, I'm invited. People want to hear this from a nice Jewish, you know, Columbia graduate young girl. They don't want to hear it from the Palestinians themselves. And to me, it's actually ironic that I am given such a strong voice, and yet to tell your story, you know, Basama, to tell your story when oftentimes Palestinians are not invited to tell their own stories. And to me, the racism behind that Palestinian voices are oftentimes dismissed as illegitimate, as not credible, as biased, and yet I am given a voice. So really the what I'm up against from my own community and also when I'm in Palestine from the settlers and the soldiers, it's always sort of a light version of the harassment that Palestinians receive for doing the exact same thing.
I do understand that completely, and I do understand how being dismissed as an activist in for the Palestinian cause for about 20 years now, it's oftentimes disheartening. And you know, you almost, there have been times where literally we have almost lost faith in humanity, that anything good could possibly come of this. And then we meet people like you, and our faith is renewed over and over again. I can't tell you how many Jewish Americans, and I say this all over, you know, the most common thing anytime a Palestinian or an Arab American speaks out against Israel's, oh, you just hate Jews. Oh, you're just an anti-Semite. You know, the old cliches. And I said, I wish it was that easy. I really do. It would be very easy for me just to hate all Jews. It really would. It would be easier. I could say that they're all bad, and then whatever happens, they deserve it. But that's just not the case. So you have groups of people that you absolutely work side by side with, love, cherish as dear, dear friends. You, I know historically in my family, my grandfather was partner with a Jewish man. As a matter of fact, later during the Muhajara, when they became refugees, the first refugee status, it was he that actually saved my grandfather's life and his family's life. So for us to sit here and just you know, give it a blanket statement, we just hate Jews, is it makes people comfortable, I think, for them to want to believe that. But it certainly isn't a fact. It just makes it easier for them to accept and swallow the truth. You know, Anna, in a few days, the people of Palestine will be commemorating the 61st anniversary of al-Nakba, the catastrophe. Israel, on the other hand, is celebrating the birthday of Israel and its Independence Day. How can Israelis justify celebratory events in light of the horrible actions, the suffering, and the misery it has suffered upon Gaza and the people of Palestine, especially in most recent times?
Well, I think for the average Jewish person, and as well as Israelis, but I think to a larger extent even Jewish Americans, the existence of Israel seems really as a miracle of moving so quickly from a state of victimhood in World War II to one of empowerment in creating their own state, a Jewish state. Of course, we know that a Jewish state was created on the ruins of an entire society, that in order to create a Jewish state, you needed a Jewish majority. And at the time, most of the people living in the area were Christians and Muslims. And so to create Israel required the cleansing of the area, in the words of Zionist leaders, of the non-Jewish population. And so that as you say, that time is celebrated by Israelis as Independence Day, mourned by Palestinians as al-Nakba. And I sort of see it kind of as a blind spot that the pride that many Israelis feel in having a Jewish state sort of maybe blinds them to the realities of what it required. I mean, to some extent, it's also propaganda, that the myth that somehow Palestinians had left voluntarily, not that that in any way just justifies their not being able to return, but that they had left out of anti-Semitism to push the Jews into the sea. These are all ways of sort of justifying to oneself that it's okay, that we can, you know, it's us or them, and we won, and that's it. But of course, the reality is not at all that Palestinians left to push the Jews into the sea. As you say, actually, the people who had been living in the area prior to Zionist immigration, the Palestinians, they were Christians, they were Muslims, and they were Jews. Palestinian, Arab, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and they had been coexisting pretty harmoniously, like your grandfather talks about. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's interesting to note that Jews had lived better, actually, within the Arab world than pretty much anywhere within the Christian world before Zionist immigration began. So it is important when we talk about Israel's creation and what Israel has done ever since that point in order to maintain this artificial majority, you know, in order to prevent those Christians and Muslims who also have rights from getting those rights or from coming back. Everything that Israel does in with this intention is it has to fundamentally be discriminatory and as well as racist, and these things, discrimination, racism, segregation, oppression, occupation, these things have nothing to do with Judaism. What Israel's doing is fundamentally opposed to Judaism. So when I hear people talking about anti-Semitism as if to argue argue against oppression is to argue against Judaism. I mean, what do they think that Judaism is? Judaism has celebrated a history of social justice, and it is still very much alive, as you know from Jewish colleagues in the movement. I say, you know, what Israel's doing is anti-Jewish. It's also anti-Semites because Arabs are Semites too. And we have to clarify between these distinctions of what it means to be Jewish, Israeli, or Zionist. There are Jews who aren't Israeli, like me. There are Israelis who aren't Jewish, like the Palestinians with Israeli citizenship. There are Jews who are anti-Zionist, and then there are Zionists who aren't Jewish, the Christian Zionist movement. So these are separate things, and we always have to clarify them to not fall into these holes of name calling and that kind of nonsense.
You know, Anna, one of the things that I think that no matter how much we say that we can get around it, the one thing that the Israeli government has never been able to get around is the illegal settlements and the they're being used to muscle in more and more on Palestinian territory as we speak. Virtually as we speak, settlements are being built. Even though the presidency of this country in two presidencies have said that they are the direct cause for the dissension in the area. Can you tell our listeners how the settlements look if you're in Palestine and watch and looking at them?
Sure. It's very striking. So I was living for about 8 months over a period of several years in a small village called Hadis. It's a Palestinian village. And like many Palestinian villages, it's an agricultural community living off of the land in the area, olive groves. And essentially in the West Bank, which is very hilly and full of olive groves, day after day, hilltop after hilltop is occupied by oftentimes ideological settlers. So these are settlers who come in often in the middle of the night with trailers and basically set up camp on a hilltop. The hills belong to some Palestinian farmer in the area. And, you know, the farmer wakes up the next morning and there's this outpost on his land and he can't do anything about it. Palestinians aren't allowed to have any kind of weapons in the area, while Israeli settlers tend to be very heavily armed with U.S. weapons, by the way. Of course, we must not forget in this conversation the role that we as Americans play in funding the segregation, the apartheid, the oppression that Israel is doing to the Palestinians in the occupied territories and elsewhere. And so basically the armed settlers set up camp. The army doesn't do much to stop them, maybe even stands there to protect them against angry Palestinians, you know, understandably angry because their land has just been taken. And then the settlements, the outposts grow over time, and they'll build a school and a swimming pool. Again, this is on land where Palestinians often don't even have enough to drink. And the settlements grow over time. And at this point, there are hundreds of settlements all over the West Bank, dotting the entire landscape. People have lost their livelihoods. The trees that are taken. I mean, this is the history of the Palestinian people. This is what they make their living from. And it's the history. It's the future of the people. It's so fundamental to Palestinian life, as well as just the ability to get to work or to school, which is made impossible by things like the settlements and the segregated roads, as well as, of course, the checkpoints and walls and everything like that. So anyway, the settlements are forever growing. Some people are confused when I say that because they remember when the settlers were removed from Gaza in 2005, which they indeed were. About 8,000 settlers were removed from Gaza and then replaced with about 12,000 new settlers in the West Bank. So the West Bank settler population has grown steadily since, while, of course, Gaza remains occupied for other reasons besides settlement. And the settlements are a big issue. And of course, as you point out, it's one of the only, it's one of, let's say, many things that are, that Israel really can't even justify in the name of security. You know, if you want to secure your population, why would you give them a lot of times the settlers move for money. Why would you pay them to go move onto somebody else's land? You know, and that's what Israel is doing. Most of the settlers move there. That's right.
And they are paid sometime up to 20,000 American dollars or shekels.
I think
it translates into 20,000 American dollars for a settler to actually move into a settlement.
That's right. In fact,
American tax dollars, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when we say Israel's paying its citizens to move there, and by the way, I mean, for example, the transportation is subsidized, mortgages are subsidized. If you stay for 10 years, you don't have to pay back your mortgage anymore. Everything is made cheaper so that Israelis are sort of given incentives to move onto more occupied Palestinian land. So when Israel talks about the sort of impossibility of removing settlers, let's remember that actually 4 out of 5 of the settlers are moving there because they're being paid to be there. And it's good that you mentioned, you know, when we say Israel's paying its settlers, that's really our tax money, you know, that's coming from our pocketbooks. And oftentimes, because of the controversial nature of this issue, people kind of shy away from it. They don't want to get involved. And the thing is, we are already involved. You know, if you're paying taxes here in this country, you are involved whether you want to be or not. And so not being involved is being someone complicit as their government continues to do something so wrong. So it's not really even an option. It's, are we going to be complicit, one of the people who didn't speak out, or are we going to be one of the people who did speak out? And that's what that's the movement I'm part of to try and build in this country to stop what our government is doing.
Well, I assure you, you're on the right side. What I'd like to discuss briefly, and this is something that I just heard tonight, the two-state delusion. Is it a and you know, many of us are getting to the point, obviously, the sectioning off and the chopping up of the Palestinian territories. And when I say chopping up, I mean that literally. I mean between the wall, the checkpoints, the barriers, all of the every possible technique used to literally separate one parcel of land from another has been implemented. And now they're saying, okay, now let's talk about a Palestinian state. That's fine. We can call it whatever we want. We still call it Palestine. It is Palestine. It was never legally changed otherwise. Even to this day, the solidification of the Constitution and the parameters of what and where Israel begins and ends has never been definitive. And in that case, any kind of sovereignty in the United Nations will require a sovereign nation to define its borders. Israel cannot do that. It's never done that. So as far as I'm concerned, it still legally has not met the requirements of the United Nations for its sovereignty. So in effect, and this is something that a lot of people do forget, it is still an illegal state.
Wow, yeah, that's a great point.
It really is. It's never been defined, and no one will ever be able to define it because it is an expansionist state, and that's the key.
Exactly.
Now,
and to have an image of
how do they justify that? We can have a Palestine, but is it a viable Palestine? Is it a sustainable Palestine? Will it sustain a society? Will it sustain an economy? Will it sustain an agricultural development for people? No, it will not.
And it's really crucial, I think, there's one thing that tells the story well, more than even voices, is maps, and the way that Palestine, starting out the entire area of historic Palestine, has been squeezed into these smaller and smaller little areas. Not unlike if you looked at the land controlled by the indigenous population in this country going from just a few hundred years ago to today, going from almost the entire area to these tiny ghettos. We have a nice word for them here. American Indians, for all they've suffered and continue to, they do legally at least have equal rights, whereas in Palestine, the indigenous population continues to be treated as foreigners in their own land. Even within Israel, where some have Israeli citizenship, they are treated as second or third class citizens. And then, of course, most of the Palestinians in the area living under occupation do not have rights, even though they are under the control of this of this other government. And so Israel indeed has control over the area. The question, of course, being, well, Israel has been very clear in the past, Zionist leaders have been clear that their intention is to expand into the whole of historic Palestine. This was part of the Zionist vision and even articulated at the time of partition to say, well, this is the first step towards realizing our goals of having the entire area. This is no secret. But if Israel is sure that it wants the whole area and it controls the whole area, why wouldn't it define its borders? Why wouldn't it say, okay, this entire area here now is Israel? It didn't stop it in 1948. Well, the answer, of course, is that if Israel were to declare that this entire area that they control now is Israel, if you annex an area, what do you have to do? You have to give rights to the people there. You know, if the U.S. were to annex Iraq, make it a 51st state, which of course they should never do, but if they were, at least Iraqis would probably receive U.S. citizenship. Well, Israel cannot grant citizenship and equal rights to the people under its control, precisely because if it did, it would no longer have that Jewish majority that is so essential to the ethno-nationalist Zionist movement. And so the occupation is a way of really controlling the area without having to actually give equal rights to the people on the area. And so when we talk about, you know, a two-state solution, we are talking about a series of ghettos that Palestinians have been limited to, even though they still have rights to much of the rest of Palestine, as do the refugees in the diaspora, even more people. And so talking about a two-state solution, I mean, first of all, it's just, if you look at the maps, it's so unviable. I mean, how do you create a viable Palestinian state out of this sort of Swiss cheese? Or really, it's more like the holes in the Swiss cheese. But the other thing is that the idea that somehow this conflict is solved by sort of complete ethnic separation, as if to solve apartheid in South Africa, you would want to create a state for black people and a state for white people, or to solve slavery in this country, one for people of color, one for Caucasians. I mean, the idea that the best solution is ethnic separation, it doesn't counter the racism and the discrimination. In fact, it reinforces it. And so not only is the two-state solution unviable, it's also, I believe, unethical and reinforces this idea that Palestinians don't have right to those lands and that somehow these communities that have coexisted harmoniously in the past, that they should not receive equal rights, that preferential treatment should be given to a particular religion or ethnicity in parts of historic Palestine.
Well, so much, you know, I can't even begin to tell you how many ways we can explain that this isn't a viable solution, and unless there is justice for the Palestinians, an ability to sustain themselves in a viable state, eventually, even if there were peace now, eventually through generations, the anger would become resurgent. It would come right back. And we would be starting it all over again. You know, the Israelis have softened the apartheid wall, and they call it a separation barrier. I know I've seen the separation barrier. Anna, have you?
Yes, I have. The euphemistically called. I mean,
it looks like a duck, and it feels like a duck, and it quacks like a duck. It's a duck. That's a wall.
I mean, for listeners.
Wall.
So for the record, there are sections of it that are at its base a wire fence, and those areas are in areas where there aren't Palestinians living better, for example, through olive groves. That wire fence is then reinforced with heavy-duty electric sensory wire, razor wire, thermal imaging, sniper towers. It is nothing like a fence in your backyard. It's like a fence surrounding prisons here in the United States. And then, of course, in the populated areas, that's where that 25-foot concrete wall is. And let me tell you, it is no fence. It is a wall. It is twice the height of the Berlin Wall, incredibly intimidating in just the way that it looks. And, of course, it's weaving not between Palestinian towns and Israeli towns, but actually weaving through Palestinian areas, separating Palestinians, not from Israelis, but from Palestinians, from their families, their communities, their jobs, and their schools, their hospitals, and their livelihoods, their lands, sort of not so coincidentally the major resources, including water, most of all, are ending up on the Israeli side of the wall, out of the reach of Palestinians. But if they maybe had a well next to their house, now the wall is built right up against their house, so the well's on the Israeli side. So it's very clear looking at the root of this wall, even though when we hear about it in the media, it seems, well, they're fighting, so just separate them. It may seem somehow logical. When you see the way that the wall is actually implemented, it doesn't make sense within the context of security. And, of course, the question should always be asked, does separation, does segregation even bring peace? And, you know, as we talk about the fact that the two-state solution is so unviable, we, of course, want to talk about alternatives as well, not just say what's wrong, but what would it look like if rather than building walls, full rights were extended to everybody in the area? And this is, of course, what Palestinian leadership has called for in the past and to some extent continues to call for today. In fact, I met with the number two of Hamas in Damascus, and he talked about the fact that that was indeed an option were Israelis willing to live as equals in historic Palestine with the Palestinian people. And the reason full democracy would never be voluntarily agreed to by Israel is because if you give everyone equal rights and you have a democracy, then Israel loses its Jewish character. So ultimately it's a question between Israel's ethnic character or its democratic one, and you really can't have both the Jewish and the democratic together.
Absolutely. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu, Anna, recently said, and this I thought was, an ongoing series of intimidation and tactics that are blatantly defiant of any kind of a peace process. What he said was, and for years the issue has been that the Palestinians accept the state of Israel, although they have, not only during Oslo, they have accepted it when Colin Powell, the PLO leader, Yasser Arafat at the time, wrote it out in handwritten form. They stated it on the grounds of the United Washington, D.C. Over and over and over again, they have accepted the state of Israel. Hamas did not accept the state of Israel. But at that time, Hamas was not neither the government nor even a consideration of the government. They were just a clandestine organization that arose out of the need of the people. Now, what Netanyahu is saying right now is that he will not even consider negotiating peace with Palestine until the Palestinian government accepts that Israel was a Jewish state. Is that a democracy or is that a theocracy?
Yeah, I mean, let's think about really what Netanyahu's saying. So Israel, again, is a state only of the Jewish people. It's not the state of its citizens. It's not the state of the people who come from the area. It's the state, it's my state. You know, I'm from California, and I've lived a life of real privilege, but it's my state. It acts on my behalf, and it's not the state of a bunch of people who aren't citizens, who have lived there all their lives as well as their families, who are really treated as strangers in their own land. And the ones who are in Israel are the lucky ones, of course. The majority of Palestinians either live under occupation or in the diaspora where they don't even have the luxury of living in the occupied territories. And so, you know, to ask a Palestinian person, do you recognize the right for there to be a state on your historic homeland that explicitly excludes you and your children and your people because of your religion and your ethnicity? When Hamas or when any Palestinian says, I don't think there's a right for a place that excludes me on my land, is that anti-Semitism? You know, is that a reasonable condition to place? Because for Palestinians to recognize Israel's right to exist means to recognize the right that Israel supposedly had in kicking them out and in preventing them from coming back. It's to deny their own national rights as well as their human rights. Nonetheless, as you say, Palestinian leadership has made that tremendous compromise and actually recognized Israel. It didn't make any difference. This is a red herring. This is an excuse. The question of Israel's right to exist is not what it's about. Israel really has no incentive to negotiate with Hamas because it's not being held to any standards. It's simply allowed to do as it wants. The U.S. prevents any meaningful work on the part of the United Nations. And we continue to give it a carte blanche with, you know, billions of dollars in checks at the beginning of the year, which they then, of course, earn interest on. So it doesn't really have an incentive to negotiate with Hamas. And, you know, I mean, the irony that the conditions held that Hamas is held to, so that they should recognize the right of Israel to exist, that they should lay down their arms, that they should that they should recognize previous agreements. Israel has never met any of these conditions. Israel doesn't recognize the right of Palestinians to be there, to Palestine to exist. It doesn't lay down its arms. It commits much more heinous crimes than Palestinians do. If you look just at the death statistics, you know, 100 to 1 these days. And it doesn't recognize previous agreements either. So the idea that Hamas is held to a condition that Israel is never held to, as we hand over tens of millions of dollars a day, it really shows the hypocrisy here. It's not about the right to exist. It's about expansionism. It's about imperialism, and most of all, it's about this colonial expansionist Zionist project prioritizing the Jewish state over the rights of the indigenous people.
You know, briefly, I want to touch on this, and I don't want to take this into any kind of a religious connotation, but one of the things that I'm concerned about is that oftentimes people consider this a religious war. Palestine, Israel, this is the way it must be. Let's sit back and wait for the Christ to return, and everything will be honky-dory. The problem with this is, first of all, whether or not the Christ returns has nothing to do with the fact that we live in a society based on laws and legislation. People ask me often, Anna, what is the solution? The solution is easy. People don't want to see it, but it is really very simple. And the solution is to apply the law equally to Israel, just like it applies it to everyone else. Once you apply the law, then all of these things become non-existent. They don't exist anymore. The settlements would have to go. The wall is illegal would have to go. The occupation would have to stop. All of these things would have to happen. Withdrawal would have to come about because it is an illegal occupation of a land. Now, these are the things that a lot of people, and yet people insist on wanting to make it a religious war. Do you really think it is?
In my experience, not at all. I mean, there are religious aspects, and you've brought up one of them, the fact that the Christian right is very, not all of the Christian right even, but Christian Zionist movement, which talks about fueling this conflict to bring about the Armageddon, just the return of the Messiah. Again, we're not talking about a pro-Jewish prophecy here about preserving Judaism, on the contrary. But anyway, the Christian Zionist movement is admittedly more and more influential, and so that their religion begins to play a role. And of course, the decision to create a Jewish state in historic Palestine as opposed to other areas, the fact that much of the Zionist movement wanted historic Palestine, has to do with a historic tie and in part a biblical tie. But in terms of sort of the way that things play out on the ground, I mean, the average Israeli is secular, as are most Jews in the world at this point. If you stop an Israeli settler and ask, what are you doing there? They're there because it's cheaper to live there and they can give their kids a better life there. I mean, there is a ultra-religious minority within the Israeli, within Israel, and they are disproportionately powerful, much maybe the way that the Christian right is here in this country, and they are able to push policies in many ways. But if you look at, for example, with the settlers, it's so clear. Yes, there are settlers who walk around, parade around with guns, and actually torment, harass Palestinians, push them off their lands with our U.S. weapons. But you know, it's too easy to say, well, it's just their fault. I mean, they're able to go there precisely because the Israeli government pays them to go there. gives them the arms to do it, comes with its soldiers, and prevents any backlash from the Palestinian society. It simply protects the settlers. And so it's too easy simply to talk about the religious aspects. We're talking about the state of Israel, the state itself, the government that is behind this aggressive colonization and is protecting this religious right. And, you know, there's going to be religious, you know, communities in any society, and some that may go so far as to disrespect others, and they should be held accountable in any society. If the government itself is then getting behind them and supporting them, then we're talking about a flaw in the government, and it's not so much a religious one as it is the common goal of expansionism. So even if the government may be secular at times, since they also intend to expand in the area, they're happy to use the religious parts of Israeli society to do that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've often said is that, you know, people will say to me, as a Palestinian, as an activist, as a vocal person in this area, they'll say to me, well, you know, you just are so angry about this. You know, Israel isn't so bad. It's there to stay. And I say, that's fine. I have no problem with the fact that it's there to stay. But it has to be the laws have to be applicable to it, or it becomes an unpleasant, unforgiving, criminal neighbor. And at that point, do you want me to love the criminal? Should I love Jeffrey Dahmer, who killed people, because he's a criminal? I don't want him in my neighborhood. I don't want criminals in my neighborhood. And if you are, now what's happening here is not only are the settlers playing out a criminal scenario, they are being paid to be criminals. And it is accepted blatantly all over the world. And people sit back and they say, well, why don't you like Israel? Well, we didn't have any problem with Israel. We never had any problems with Jews. Jews have always lived in the Middle East. This isn't anything new to us. It's European Jews. It's Jews from L.A. that suddenly moved in and said, hey, I have a right to this land. You have to move out. It's stories like yours that have visited the region. It's stories like a young Jewish activist that I had met many years ago who still remembers why she became a Palestinian activist, because she stood at the door while the IDF soldiers evacuated a family so they could have their home. She never got over that. To this day, her tears flowed as she spoke of it. Those are the things that that we become angered at. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, things like religion, here this week, the Holy See, Pope Benedict has been in Jerusalem, and and I often wonder, under the curse of occupation, how they can still justify. Now, I for one am not a Holocaust denier. I believe that humankind has the capacity to do such dark deeds. I truly believe that. I witnessed for 61 years what a nation of people that have suffered under the hands of such brutality become brutal. So I know that this is possible. And yet, how much compassion can society in general continue to have 61 years later for a nation that has just almost annihilated an entire nation of people completely? And it's unforgiving.
I think we can always have compassion for the people. I do think the Zionist project is driven by fear that is actually founded on, you know, real past traumas, but continues in a way that that is destructive for everybody involved. I don't think it's so much sort of, okay, how, you know, like when can we stop feeling sorry for them? I mean, the whole point is that what we should learn from past tragedies is that we cannot be silent when tragedies are happening, that anybody should be held accountable when it's violating people's rights, and that we all have to speak out and prevent things from recurring. And, you know, to me, the idea that in order to create a space for the Jewish diaspora to go, for understandable reasons, they wanted a space. In order to create that space, we need to precisely deny space to a whole other people, to create a whole new refugee diaspora population. This is something I reject. It will never, I mean, even if the intention is to create a safe space, it simply will not be effective. Is Israel a safe place for Jews? It's one of the worst places for Jewish people to go, because precisely its existence requires the discrimination against non-Jews. So whatever the the reasons and whatever the fear behind it, and I know that fear, I know it personally, and I also I respect it because I know the space that it comes from. But also it's irrational to think that by violating other people's rights we will ever be safer. And really to assure anyone's safety, we need to look out for everybody's safety, and that includes Palestinians, and finding some way other than to it being an us versus them model, rather one in which we have a sort of a common goal of living together peacefully. And that really can't work within a Zionist framework of a state where one ethnic or religious population is favored over another. And just to comment on the question of sort of getting over it and Israel's there to stay, I mean, the fact that the Palestinian, the monstrous injustice that has occurred to the Palestinian people continuously, but particularly with Israel's creation, the first Nakba between 1947 and 1949, I mean, we're talking about an injustice that has never even been acknowledged, you know, officially by Israel, not even apologized for. I mean, the idea that one should just sort of get over it when it hasn't been acknowledged, and when it continues, and to a large extent, I mean, the annexation of Palestinian land, the pushing off of the people, continues today through house demolitions, through tearing up the olive groves, building the wall between communities. I mean, it's ongoing, and the idea of sort of coming together and forgiving and holding hands while the injustice is happening. I mean, truth and reconciliation in South Africa didn't happen during apartheid. It happened after apartheid, once the racist infrastructure had been addressed, and there it became the time for healing. So the idea that somehow you, Basima, and other Palestinians should sort of get over it is absurd. And of course, you know that. you know that yourself. But yes. Yeah.
You know, I have, we have been remiss. I'm going to try to fit in a couple of questions. I know you have to leave very soon, so we're just going to try to get a couple of questions in from our listeners. I am in England. Oh,
before,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to say, because I know we won't get as many questions as we want, I'm actually at UC Irvine now in California, about to go on to give a presentation. I also have a website, and it's annainthemiddleeast.com. So that's A-N-N-A in the Middle East, all one word, .com. And there people can, if they don't get their question, and they can email me, ask their question. I do read every email. As long as it's respectful, I will respond. And people can also find out more about my schedule, my email list, and especially my book, Witness in Palestine, and my DVD, to see the presentation I've been giving around the country.
And just
so again,
you know,
that's annainthemiddleeast.com.
The book is brilliant. It really is. It is very, very informative. I'm going to ask one question. I am Steve from England, because we have an English listener. My question is, how frequent would Galloway's breaches of the Gaza siege have to be before the siege became irrelevant and supplies could flow freely?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
In fact, here I am at UC Irvine, and this is part of a conference that's going to be including Mr. Galloway. This breaking of the siege, for anyone who isn't familiar, is Viva Palestina, an incredible initiative to basically transport goods via the shores of Gaza, the international waters and Gazan waters, which Israel has been patrolling and controlling now for ever since Gaza was occupied 42 years ago. That's an excellent question. I guess I don't know exactly the answer. I do know that there's certainly a point, there's a point where Israel doesn't want it to be sort of a non-issue and would rather let boats come in just to, so nobody's sort of, it's not it doesn't get sort of bad media press and just maybe nobody will notice. But at a certain point, if their siege becomes ineffective, of course, is when they would tighten up. So, for example, in fact, speaking here will be Cynthia McKinney, the 2008 presidential candidate for the Green Party here in the U.S., and she was on one of the Free Gaza boats that was then rammed by the Israeli military during its winter siege on Gaza this past winter. So I believe that the Israeli government, first of all, will not allow people to break the siege continuously if it actually threatens their domination in the area. At the moment, I think it's probably considered better for them politically to just kind of let it happen. And so the question will be, indeed, once it gets to the point where it's really challenging Israeli domination, what would happen? And hopefully, with initiatives like Galloway's, the international movement continues to build, and ultimately Israel will have no choice but to comply with international law. But that is truly up to us, not just Galloway, not just the U.S. government, but all of us to get involved. And people can learn more about that on my website, too.
Well, thank you, Anna. You're a doll for being with us. Please give our best to Cynthia and to George Galloway. They're friends of our show and have been on our show a couple of times. We appreciate you. Keep up the good work, and I'm going to let you go because I know you've got a presentation to do. You have a great evening.
Thank you so much. And, again, anyone who's interested can look at my website, annainthemiddleeast.com, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thanks so much, Bassem. That's an honor.
You're welcome, Habibti. Bye-bye.
Bye, Habibti.
Okay, guys, there you have it. Just a fantastic woman. She really is. Next week, our guest will be Ellen Brown, an economic analyst that wrote the book The Web of Debt, and we're looking forward to having you with us. That's all for tonight, folks. Let the people speak.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in the Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
Join the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, an international three-month event spanning seven continents and over 1 million participants. With endorsements from luminaries worldwide such as President Jimmy Carter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The World March for Peace and Nonviolence seeks to bring attention to the need to end war and occupation, reduce arms spending, and all forms of violence. Please visit theworldmarch.org.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the stable, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
PBSRadio.com